Hello and welcome to the Focus podcast. I'm Louise, the digital editor of Focus, the monthly science and technology magazine from the BBC. With me in the studio are Graham, Andy and Dan. Later in the podcast...
This allows you to study with a very high precision the static properties of neutrons.
Our report on the latest research using neutrons on site at the ILL nuclear reactor in France.
Those particles that are smashed together in the LHC reveal cosmic secrets, but guess what? They come from nothing more glamorous than a bottle of hydrogen gas.
BBC Click presenter Gareth Mitchell answers your science questions.
We're doing a themed episode on Bang, all about nuclear power and trying to look at it rationally.
And presenter Dallas Campbell's top moments from the new series of Bang Goes the Theory. But now it's news time. What stories have you all spotted this month?
Okay, well, a dinosaur horn discovered in the US provides more evidence that dinosaurs came to a rather abrupt end. One of the leading culprits for the demise of dinosaurs is a huge asteroid strike about 65 million years ago, at a time known as the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary. But it's also suspected that other events, such as volcano eruptions, may have played a part. What's added to the debate is a zone in the Earth that's roughly 3 metres wide, right below the zone marking the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary. Now, no dinosaur fossils have been found here, apparently indicating that they died out sometime before the asteroid hit Earth. But now, a horn that's nearly 18 inches long and most likely belonged to a Triceratops has been discovered in this zone in Montana. Paleontologists are keen to point out that the dinosaurs could have been declining in numbers before the asteroid struck, but the Triceratops in Montana does show that they would have been around when the impact took place.
So that does put more weight on the idea that this asteroid played a big part.
Yeah, exactly. There was a sort of a gap in time between when the asteroid struck and the sort of the sort of end of the fossils, apparently. But now this fossil find appears to show that they would have been around at the time of the asteroid strike. So, yeah, it appears that, to add weight to that.
Interesting stuff. And Dan, what news have you got for us?
So this week I was fascinated by this possible new treatment for voice disorders. Now, these disorders are usually the result of scarred tissue forming on vocal cords, and this hinders their elasticity and stops people from being able to speak. But rather than solve the problem with a biological solution, a team of Harvard and MIT researchers have come up with a mechanical one. Dr. Stephen Zeitels, who he counts Julie Andrews and Stephen Tyler among his patients.
Wow.
some good names there. Decided that rather than attacking the scar tissue that had built up, a better approach would be to create a physical fix for it. Now, to do this, they enlisted some chemical engineers from MIT who toyed with the properties of a medically safe material called polyethylene glycol, or otherwise known as PEG. They played with its molecular structure until they arrived at a new material that was both medically safe and flexible enough to mimic vocal cords.
So what would the treatment entail then?
So essentially, if it's given approval by the FDA, the board that approves or bans all drugs in the US, a patient would come in and they'd have this material injected over their scarred tissue and it would restore the elasticity of the cords. And that treatment would have to happen every 6 months because it's actually able to be broken down by the body, which is part of what makes it safe.
So is it kind of acting as a replacement cord then?
No, it's not. It won't replace a cord, but it will go over the regions that have lost. You know, they have the scarring, so it makes it bumpier in a sense, and it's sort of like a bit like polyfiller. It smooths it over.
Oh right,
and restores its ability to vibrate and create the sounds that we know with speech.
Brilliant stuff. A story I really liked from the Science News this week was that a rainbow-coloured toad has been rediscovered in the jungles of Southeast Asia after being lost to science for nearly 90 years. The Sambas stream toad, or the Bornean rainbow toad, as it's also called, was thought to be extinct, and it was last spotted in 1924 by European explorers.
That's some time ago.
It is some time ago, so obviously they completely thought it was extinct.
We just lost it.
No, they haven't lost it. It's a different term. It's called the rainbow toad. Of course, you want to know why, because its back is covered with bright red, green, yellow and purple warts. So it must be quite a sight to see. But it was found using black and white drawings from the 1920s, of course. And there's knowledge of only three recorded specimens. So it's really quite a brilliant thing that it's been found. The organisation Conservation International suspected that the toad might still be alive, and they included it in one of their 10 most wanted amphibians list last year that they released. That's part of a global campaign to find species that they thought have gone extinct, but there might actually be some around that we haven't got recorded. The search team from the University of Malaysia looked at related species to predict the toad's behaviour and work out where it might live if there were any still alive. The rainbow toad is only the second species from that most wanted list to be found, along with the brilliantly named endangered Rio Pescado stubfoot toad, which is from Ecuador, which has also been found, but there's eight that they still haven't found.
Does the toe, the name of its toe, have anything to do with what it looks like?
I'm not sure. I need to check out a picture of that, because the rainbow toad sounds absolutely brilliant. And Graham, for us, you've actually got an event that you went to yesterday, is that right?
That's right, yes. I went to the unveiling of a statue of Yuri Gagarin, the first man in space. It was in London, on the Mall. And it was unveiled by his daughter, Elena, and it marks 50 years since his visit to Britain in 1961. That was the same year he actually made his historic space flight. Now, also there was Natalia Korolyova. Now, she's the daughter of the Soviet chief designer, Sergei Korolev. And he was really responsible for the whole Soviet space program. So it's a huge honor to meet her. And I asked Natalia what was her father's greatest achievement. I mean, he was, after all, the man who put the first man-made satellite, Sputnik, into space. He managed the first spacewalk, all of those things. She said it was Gagarin's flight, which only lasted one orbit around the Earth, but really set the tone for the next few years. But I think you could possibly make a case that his greatest achievement was the R7 rocket, because it's a derivative of that rocket which is still used today to ferry astronauts to the International Space Station. And with the demise of the space shuttle, this technology that he pioneered will actually remain the only means of ferrying human beings up to the space station. So although the United States won the race to put the first man on the moon, it seems in the long run, the Soviet Union, you know, might have had the last laugh. Although today is all about international cooperation. I also had a brief chat to Sergei Krikalev, who's the cosmonaut who spent the most time in space. And he said that, you know, the most significant thing about this is it led to international cooperation. But it'd be interesting to see what happens next.
It's been a really significant year, hasn't it, for anniversaries of spaceflight and things.
And quite pertinent at the moment, given that it does seem that Russia have stuck with tried and tested technology, and they're taking over now from the States, who tried something different and are now abandoning that. And so, yeah, it's all very pertinent.
Yes, I mean, if anything, the shuttle was, you know, possibly too advanced for its time.
Right.
And that led to it being very expensive to fly, and full of technical problems. And so they just couldn't launch enough shuttles, you know, to make it economically worthwhile. And so the old standard tried and tested technology, you know, it is the cheapest way of getting satellites and people into space. But and there's certainly other developments on the cards, like space plane, but it could be quite a few years away.
Thanks for those. Coming up, our Gadget of the Month, an exclusive report from the ILL Neutron Research Facility, and your Q&As with BBC Click presenter Gareth Mitchell. The new series of Bang Goes the Theory starts on Monday the 15th of August. We caught up with presenter Dallas Campbell, and after some deliberation, he picked his top three moments from filming the series.
So my number one highlight would probably be the film I did on memory, and I had to learn the entire periodic table in a hour and a half, or a couple of hours. And it kind of sprang from this idea that lots of random things in our life we remember very, very vividly, and yet I can't remember where I've done with my keys. So we made a film about memory. And the way that we remember things and the way that recall works, and as a sort of way of demonstrating how memory works and how we can remember things better, I learned the periodic table, the entire thing, so you can test me from one, from hydrogen to ananoctium. Number two is probably the fact that we are running out of helium. A good percentage of the world's helium happens to be in a sort of geological storage tank, if you like. Not a tank at all. It's in the rocks underneath Amarillo in Texas. Amarillo, of course, famous for the song. But, of course, helium is you can only get helium from sort of nuclear processes. And so on Earth, it's a limited resource. So every time you let a balloon go at a kid's party, you're kind of wasting a valuable resource. So I went to examine the impending helium crisis in Amarillo in Texas. Number three is a very, I guess, a controversial issue. Obviously, nuclear power is back in the headlines, not just because of Fukushima, but because of the government's proposal for building new nuclear power stations. We're doing a themed episode on Bang, all about nuclear power and trying to look at it rationally and trying to get a good idea of the hows, whys, and wherefores of nuclear power. I was up in Dounreay, which is one of our very, very first atomic piles built in the UK, perhaps second to sort of the Windscale atomic pile, which is now not producing electricity, but they're dismantling it. So that question of nuclear waste, the big question that I think people worry about nuclear power, what do we do with the waste, I looked at in great detail at Dounreay, and it was fascinating and an eye-opener. And I think that's sort of stayed with me, that particular film.
Dallas Campbell there. Now it's over to our reviews editor, Dan, for August's Gadget of the Month.
So this month, we've been looking at 3D TVs. And in our test, which you can see in the August issue, we took three TVs that have recently, the first 3D TV has just dropped below the £1,000 price barrier, which finally sort of makes them affordable. And we wanted to see, out of the current crop, which is the best to buy. And the TV that won it this month was an LG 3D set. To give it its full, rather dull name, it's LG 42LW550T.
Doesn't exactly trip off the tongue, does it?
No, it's not one to stick in your mind. But and the reason that one, out of the three sets, the main reason that one won is because with these 3D TVs, you obviously have to wear these glasses that are cumbersome and a bit ugly. And there is a system called Active Systems that require glasses that can be quite expensive. Now, all of the Active System sets that we tested only came with one of these glasses. Mm. So then you'd have to buy another set for, if you happen to live with other people, which most people do, that would cost £50. And then for every subsequent person you wanted to enjoy that film with, you'd have to buy another set. And the LG came with the same sort of glasses that you actually use in the cinema, these sort of light, disposable, throwaway ones. If the kids break them, it doesn't matter. And they're just a few pounds to get more frames for. And indeed, the actual set come with about seven or eight pairs.
So, I mean, is now a good time to buy a 3D telly? Is there much to watch?
Well, that's exactly what we were looking at. They're cheaper now. So on that front, you could say if you're going to buy one, maybe. But there just still isn't a wealth of content. You've got a few options, which is you can get some 3D Blu-rays for sort of films that you would see in the cinema.
Right.
Though, interestingly, Avatar still hasn't made it onto 3D Blu-ray. Still waiting for the deal on that one. You can get the odd channel through both Sky and Virgin, so you can get 3D content that way. But And then the sports as well, which is the main thing that would draw me to buy one.
Mm.
There's some football matches are filmed in 3D. Eurosport just did the broadcast of the Australian Open in 3D. So that there is stuff there. I mean, it's not... I mean, where we came on it is that it's not like, you should go out and buy a 3D TV set. It's just, people buy their TVs every 5 to 10 years or something. And if you see one that has that ability and you think that, it's going to add to your viewing. I mean, we likened it to, it's not like going from black and white to colour, nor is it like going from a normal TV to a big screen TV. It's just something that gives you a little bit extra. And also, if in the future, 5-10 years down the line, there might be 3D TVs that don't use glasses, the content will still be the same. So it's not like it will go out of date and you won't be able to use it anymore. You'll still be able to use the TV. So, if you're in the market, by all means, find one that has 3D if you like that kind of thing. But don't let it be the be-all or end-all of it.
Thanks, Dan. Now, have you ever wondered why children like eating sweets more than adults? BBC Click radio presenter Gareth Mitchell has the answer.
Yes, hello again, everyone. You know how it goes by now. You send in the questions, I provide some answers. The first question comes from David Bass of County Dublin.
How are particles put inside the Large Hadron Collider?
Well, David, of course, those particles that are smashed together in the LHC reveal cosmic secrets. But guess what? They come from nothing more glamorous than a bottle of hydrogen gas. Consisting of single electrons orbiting protons, the atoms are heated up until the electrons can be stripped off, and that leaves protons, and then these are directed through a series of accelerators to increase their speed. Then they're squirted into the LHC under control of gigantic magnets and accelerated to near light speeds, and at that point, they're smashed together. All right, let's have our next question.
What is space weather?
Well, of course, here on Earth, we have howling winds, we have swirling clouds and crashing storms. But there is weather, well, kind of, in space. I mean, after all, there's the solar wind. That immediately springs to mind. That's a stream of charged particles emitted by the sun. And it's most evident as the amazing northern light glowing as those particles interact with our magnetosphere. But you could also consider perhaps near-Earth asteroids as a form of space weather, because, loosely speaking, they're the solar system equivalent of hailstones. They're lumps of rock that come within a few million kilometres of Earth. Well, the next question hasn't rained in from space, but it has come from Facebook.
Do we all see the same colours? Ben Udall.
All right, Ben. Well, colour blindness aside, we all broadly agree on the colour labels that we use to describe the objects in the world around us. And colour vision evolved to allow us to spot ripe berries, poisonous mushrooms or spoiled food. So there's obviously an adaptive benefit in having a very accurately calibrated sense of colour. But people's sensitivity to different wavelengths varies because we don't all have exactly the same number of cone receptor cells of each type in our eyes. In fact, a study from Newcastle University in 2006 found evidence that some women have four types of cones instead of the normal three, and that allows them to see 100 times as many different shades as the rest of us.
Are self-replicating machines possible?
Ooh, self-replicating machines, yes, they are possible, albeit with a little bit of help from their human creators. There's an open source project called RepRap, and it allows you to build your own 3D printer for just a few hundred pounds. Now, a 3D printer is a machine for rapid prototyping. It plugs into your computer and fabricates simple objects out of plastic. There's a whole community around RepRap, and it's developed its own design for a 3D printer, along with all the electronics and software to get it going. So if you can get access to a 3D printer, then you could produce all the parts you need to build one of your own, and then you could use that to fabricate the parts for someone else to make theirs. So in effect, RepRap is a kind of self-replicating machine. All right, let's have our final question.
Do children like sweets more than adults?
And that question's been emailed to us by Richard Price. Well, growing children need lots of energy, so in evolutionary terms, they're predisposed to like sweet things. Babies prefer solutions that are even sweeter than breast milk. And children have a higher density than adults of those taste buds on the tongue that are particularly sensitive to sweet things. As children grow into teenagers, though, they then become able to distinguish more tastes, so they lose that early strong preference they had just for sweet things. In addition, our experience of food and smells and taste develops in richness as we go through our lives. It all depends on our experiences. So we end up with a much more nuanced sense of taste. So we're less susceptible just to the sweet stuff that we enjoyed so much when we were kids. And what a tasteful question that was to end with. We will have more, hopefully, equally tasteful questions and answers for you next time. So I'll see you then.
That was Gareth Mitchell. If you're scratching your head over any other queries, you can explore the Q&A archive at sciencefocus.com. Dan from the Focus team travelled to Grenoble in France recently to visit the ILL nuclear reactor. Now, when I think of a nuclear reactor, I imagine it generating power, but this one serves a very different purpose, doesn't it, Dan?
Yeah, this nuclear reactor is tweaked, in a sense, to produce a stream of neutrons, which they collect and then use for, you know, actually hundreds of different types of research. So when I went down there, I grabbed the director of the research facility, Dr. Andrew Harrison, to sort of ask him about all the kinds of research they do there.
Could you tell me a little bit about the ILL and the kind of research being done here and the sort of things that might come of the research?
Okay, so At the heart of the ILL is an intense source of neutrons, subatomic particle. And neutrons can reveal the structure of materials and the way in which the atoms and molecules move in them. So the way in which neutrons are scattered as they pass through a material tells you about structure and dynamics on an atomic scale. Now, you probably also know that you can do some of these things with X-rays, and X-rays are also a fantastic probe of structure. So we're very much a complement to X-rays. We reveal aspects of the structure that X-rays often can't. So in particular, what we're good at is showing where light atoms, for example hydrogen, are in the material. And as I'm sure you know, there are many materials in biology or functional materials, new energy materials, in which the locating where the hydrogens are and how the hydrogen atoms move is crucial. When you pass X-rays through a material, they're stopped by the heavy, dense, for example metallic object. You think of an X-ray picture of a hand with someone wearing a ring, and you'll see the ring very clearly, the hand, and you'll see the bones in the hand, but you won't see the soft tissue very clearly. Neutrons are exactly the opposite of that. Neutrons pass readily through most metals, but they're stopped by hydrogen. So, I mean, I'll give you one example. You could put a running motor, as in a car engine, in a neutron beam. And the neutrons will pass easily through the metal of the engine, but they'll be stopped by the oil. So you're able, for example, to make the complement of an X-ray image with neutrons to reveal, for example, the motion of fluids in a working motor. So it really is complementary. We do light atoms, X-rays do heavy atoms, to put it simply.
And what other materials or what kind of things are being investigated here particularly?
Oh man, I mean, there's such a... almost every realm of science and technology, which involves knowing structure and movement at an atomic level, is amenable. So, to be honest, take your pick. But to give you some examples, if you were developing a new catalyst and you wanted to know how a molecule is transformed on the surface of this catalyst, how it lands, how it breaks up, where the constituent parts go, many such materials involve simple light molecules, water, methane, whatever. And hydrogen is an integral part of that. So just one of many examples would be using neutron scattering to reveal chemical transformation on the surface of a catalyst.
Brilliant. The neutrons, how are you generating them?
So we have, at the heart of ILL, we have a nuclear reactor. In comparison with the kind of reactor that's used to generate power, it's really quite a weak source of energy. But it's tuned specially to generate neutrons, which is not normally what a nuclear reactor puts out. So that's essentially our neutron source.
Okay, and am I right in saying they're channeled from the reactor?
Yes. That's right. So they come out of the reactor in all directions, and they're enclosed in the reactor itself. And in the wall of the reactor, we have a number of tubes which are coated on the inside with what is the equivalent of a mirror. So the neutrons are bounced along these tubes and can be guided 100 meters away. So you can put your instrument very far from the reactor where the background signal from the reactor is very low. So you can perform very, very sensitive measurements at a considerable distance away from the reactor because the background noise is very, very weak.
While I was there, I also spoke to Dr. Peter Geltenbort, who's responsible for one of the more interesting bits of research that I saw there. So to find out more about what he does, which involves slowing down neutrons to an observable state, I spoke to him.
So could you tell me a little bit about the research that you've just shown us and what you're doing, particularly slowing neutrons and what you hope to find?
Okay, as you have seen, we are working at the ILL. ILL has the strongest steady neutron source in the world since 1971. Part of our research, about 15%, is devoted to nuclear and particle physics with neutrons. I am working with a very rare kind of neutrons, which we call ultra-cold neutrons. That means, with respect to temperatures, they are very low temperatures in the milli-Kelvin range, or they have very low energies, 100 nanoelectron volts, or very low speeds. That means 5 to 8 meters per second. That means even in my age, I can run faster than such an ultra-cold neutron. And the nice property of this ultra-cold neutron is that in dedicated materials, you can store them for very long times, hundreds of seconds. That means you have a very long observation time. This allows you to study with a very high precision the static properties of neutrons. Yep. What we have three flagship experiments at the time with ultra-cold neutrons. Mm-hmm. This is the search for a so-called electric dipole moment of the neutrons. This would mean that also the neutron is electrically neutral. It has inside the three quarks, which makes up the neutron, carry electrical charge. The sum is zero, but the center of gravities of these charges, positive and negative one, would not coincide. And this is an object, as with the north and the south pole, you will have a plus and a minus pole. And such an object would be sensitive to an electric field. And we try now, since more than 60 years now, one tries to measure a non-zero electric dipole moment, which must exist, otherwise we would not exist. Okay. You need an electric dipole moment, which is different from zero, for example, to explain why we have more matter in our universe, which has been measured, mm-hmm. than antimatter.
And going back to the sort of the methodology, how do you cool the neutrons as they...
We do it in a very classical way. As I said, if you have the reactor produces nuclear fission, and in nuclear fission you produce neutrons. These are fission neutrons which have a high energy. These fission neutrons are thermalized by collisions with our heavy water moderator. After a few collisions, they are in thermal equilibrium with the heavy water, which corresponds to about a temperature of 50 degrees Celsius. Okay. Then we cool them further down. We have a second moderator, which is a liquid of deuterium, now at a temperature of 25 Kelvin only, about minus 250 degrees Celsius. Again, by collisions with this deuterium at this low temperature, neutron loses energy. It becomes what we call a cold neutron. And then these cold neutrons we cool further down, and we do it here by a mechanical device, which we call a turbine. That means when the neutron hits a moving blade, which is backwards moving blade, it hits the blade, the blade moves back, it loses energy. Mm-hmm. As you would play a stop ball when you play tennis, exactly mm-hmm. the same principle. And then you can cool down these neutrons from a speed of about 50 meters per second further down to speeds of about 5 meters per second. And then those neutrons are totally reflected from suited materials. Of course, not from all material, but if you have aluminium, you can store them. You have stainless steel, you have nickel also, such materials, you can store them. And depending on the properties of the material, you can store higher energy neutrons or lower energy ultra-cold neutrons.
So, Dan, what was it like being at a nuclear reactor? Was it how you expected it to look?
Not really, actually, at all. This facility's been there since the 60s. So you've got this mix of very, very old technology, exactly like you'd expect from a Bond film or something, you know, old circuit boards with flashing lights mixed with, you know, the latest computing technology that's hardwired into this stuff to control it. And then when you get to the actual reactor, basically you've got lots of experiments going on around this central reactor, and everything's just put up with bits of scaffolding and pipes, you know, here and there, you know, and there's power tools on the floor, and it just looks like a very big shed almost.
And did you see the core itself?
Yeah, we got to see the core, which is slightly different to a normal reactor core. So normally the core would be covered with a concrete door, in case of any sort of overloads or anything dangerous. And that door is slid back when they need to get to it. But because this is a special type, they didn't need that. So it's just a core sitting in a pool of heavy water that glows this unearthly blue that's like nothing you will ever have seen before, because it doesn't spread through the water like normal light does. It just sort of dissipates, and it's almost like the water's been painted that colour. But it was a truly, truly brilliant sight to see.
And Dan took some brilliant photos on his trip, which we have put up on sciencefocus.com, so check them out. That's all for this month's podcast, but come back next month for more Q&As, gadgets, and our interview with the director of the UK Space Agency.